Business Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
Christian Takahashi is a geopolitical strategist and macroeconomist out of Switzerland. You can follow all of his work at geopoliticalresearch.com. So Christian, we have spoken with you a couple of times this year, but I do want to point out that at the beginning of this year in January, you were making a big warning on the markets for 2022. And the message that you were giving then, in addition to a number of other top name strategists that we were speaking with at the time as well, warning about the outlook for this year, was that essentially, you know, there was a number of downside risks that we were looking at. And you were particularly talking about how the markets are not pricing in and are underestimating a Fed policy shock, that the Fed is going to raise rates aggressively, that there was a lot of pressure on them to do so, especially in light of the persistent inflation that we were seeing, and the markets weren't pricing that in. And you specifically said that you were looking at about 11 months of major volatility, uncertainty, and downside risks for the stock market. And certainly, that is what we saw. So, you know, what you had to say then was right on. So I want to start with getting a sense of the big picture, given that you spend a lot of your research and time understanding the geopolitical environment, the macro economy. One big theme that we've been discussing both with you and others on the show is the ongoing breakdown of globalization and the hyper-globalized world that we saw essentially in this post-Cold War era, that is continuing to break down. And I think three different events that we can look at that have solidified this trend are the U.S.-China trade wars that started in 2018. That was then followed 2 years later by the COVID outbreak and global lockdowns in 2020. And then 2 years after that, we now have the Russia-Ukraine war and all the fallout that is coming from that in 2022. So, I mean, we've now had three events in subsequent fashion every 2 years that have essentially solidified what appears to be an ongoing breakdown of globalization. What are your thoughts as we head into 2023 from that big picture view of where things are currently?
Well, I think that the world is definitely in a transition period coming out of a Cold War order, but also a period where we had a peace dividend, right? Where capitalism and democracy seemed to really rule and advance a massive process of globalization, especially in trade and commerce. And what we are seeing definitely now is a transition towards a different order. And some people call it multipolar order. I am a bit more careful with that. It's likely to be multipolar, but multipolar may not be the most important characteristic of it. I think it's one of its most important characteristics will be that it's going to be dominated by state-run economies. You know, the big economies in that new order are going to be state-run economies. And not necessarily like the Soviet Union in the 60s, 70s, but surely not capitalistic free market economies that we've had the last 30, 40 years in the West. And I think that too much of the focus and research is focused on this, multipolar world, India joining China, Russia, US, Brazil coming along too, focusing on the nations and not so much on what is happening to the economy and our political process. And they're both, I believe, changing dramatically, changing fast. When you look at how our governments, G7 governments and some G20 governments as well, have been able to cope with the crisis of the past 4 years, 3 years that you just mentioned, they've just been doing this with an interventionism. They've been intervening, changing the rules of changing the laws, printing money, or issuing massive, gigantic guarantees with money they don't even have, markets looking the other way. So a lot of things are happening that are changing the face of our economy and our political system. So that is actually one important area, one of several areas that I think are being underestimated. And maybe a last comment that belongs to that answer is we've had three amazing years, one after the other, two COVID years, one incredible year, right, with the invasion of Ukraine by Russia and what is happening in the world. A year that we are finishing with the U.S. Inflation Protection Act, you know, if you allow me to put it that way. And I mentioned that because it connects with what you mentioned, this era of President Trump 2018, when the US went after China, right? So in 2018, 2019, the US goes after China. And in 2022, the US goes after China and Europe with this Inflation Protection Act and makes economic nationalism really, the US first, really a serious problem for many US allies and enemies. So after three busy years, I believe the whole geopolitical, economic, and political system is entering a phase of realignment. The war in Ukraine and also what is happening between the US and its own allies like Europe now, especially through the Inflation Protection Act, is forcing all actors to realign, to reparametrize what they're doing and their strategies. So I believe that 2023 might be a little bit calmer than what people assume it's going to be, especially on the surface. It's going to be a year probably of big realignments, and alliances may be shifting as well. As I've told you before, and I think we've shared in this financial sense, there are now more alliances than competing nations out there. And those, some of those alliances, I believe, are going to be rewritten or, you know, redrawn in 2023. So big things to happen, but these are things that may be happening under the surface and not necessarily at the surface.
Yeah. So as you said, you know, we're seeing this transition away from the post-Cold War world order. We're seeing many more state-run economies and much more intervention by governments and central banks into all aspects of the financial system, the global trading system. We saw that in 2018 with the U.S.-China trade wars. There was a lot of intervention into free trade to try to correct perhaps some imbalances that had occurred between the two large trading partners. In 2020, we saw the global lockdowns. That was a massive intervention by governments into the global economy on a scale that we probably haven't seen since the Great Depression. And then now we have the Russia-Ukraine war, which is also creating a number of alignments under the surface, like you said, that we should expect to see persist into 2023. You know, something that you have been discussing about that's happening under the surface is the need for oil and gas, right? So you have countries around the world desperate to get their hands on much needed oil and gas supplies. We're still in short supplies. There hasn't been enough investment into the sector for probably a decade or more. And so there are countries, they need that oil and gas from Russia, for example. China needs fossil fuels from Russia. Africa, all these different various parts of the world still need to trade with Russia. And yet at the same time, Europe's trying to cut off trade, especially, you know, with fossil fuels. And so there are these alignments that are being born out of necessity. So can you tell us about some of these alignments that you're looking at?
Some of those alignments are in part to the military shifts that we're seeing, okay? The obvious now with the war in Ukraine, but the others are more economic. And the reason is, and one important reason that very few people in the West seem to notice is that many developing nations and emerging nations, emerging powers, they don't want to become like the West or China. What do I mean with this? We have many nations in the developing world, emerging market world, that don't want to become state-run economies like the US and the EU are becoming in their view. So they are actually trying to also decouple from the US dollar and the US European banking system because they see that we're using them as a weapon now. So they actually are afraid of getting in trouble and also being forced by us to become state-run economies. You know, many of these nations have become quite conservative in the macroeconomic management. Think of Malaysia, Philippines, Indonesia, Peru, Colombia, Chile. Don't look at the politics, who is in government. The macroeconomic policies, the central banking policies are extremely conservative, much more conservative than the US or Europe's, right? Or the ones that we have in Europe. And these countries are actually being forced by us, they say, to realign themselves because what they see at the end of this is not good. They see the West hitting a wall and actually accelerating against it. So we are actually printing yet more money And now that we are not printing so much money, our governments are issuing gigantic guarantees to keep intervening in markets, supply and demand. And what they see is that the West has become the biggest source of risk. And those countries want to decouple from that risk. And they don't see this ending well. What I mean is this, and I believe, one of the most important things that is being discussed in Asia, South Asia, the Middle East, even in Africa, and parts of Latin America, that China and the West are converging. Or may I say it more correctly, what they're saying is that the West, the United States and the EU and the UK are converging towards China in terms of surveillance and ever more state interventionism. And what they see is that in the meantime, we're using crisis to keep this interventionism going on. So they realize the West has no interest in an end of wars or an end of crisis, because that is exactly what is allowing our governments to keep up the interventionistic tone. This is very important to be mentioned. And therefore, what we see now is the formation of alliances between, I would say, former enemies. Just to mention two, name India and China, okay? Or maybe even three, name India and China, name Pakistan and India, name Brazil and Argentina, real foes, real contenders, right? They're not being willing to really work together or see eye to eye in a friendly way. They've not been able to trust each other, trusting each other is so still not possible, but they've not been able to work together in a positive way because of their animosity. They have been harboring against one another. But what happened in 2022 has changed it all. And it's not the war in Ukraine, as many people falsely say. It is our use of the US dollar and the euro and the use of our banking system to hit at Russia. So it's the weaponization of the dollar, of our currencies and our banking system, that has scared really much of the world out there. It scared big companies and governments in Ghana, in Uganda, in South Africa, in Brazil, in Chile, in Colombia, even Ecuador, Philippines, Pakistan, India in a big way. The list is really long. And those nations are actually saying, okay, you know what? We don't like each other. We've had our little wars, and we will have some other wars. But regardless of that, we need to pull together, because the West is converging towards China. This is not going to end well. Actually, even before the convergence, the Western system may collapse. You know, they are really just printing money, spending more money than they have. The West is living beyond its means. We need to find a new alternative currency, or a different, or at least, if not an alternative currency, a different way that we can trade in. So Philippines is talking to Indonesia if they can trade directly with one another without using US dollars. Malaysia is talking to the Philippines. They can trade with one another without using US dollars. Brazil is doing the same with Argentina, the same with Peru, the same with other countries. I mean, everybody's talking to one another, and they have not all been able to do it yet. You know, these are just in some countries that I mentioned, it's just been contact, government to government, just a contact. Nothing has been done yet, but there are some countries, for instance, in Southeast Asia, where it's gone beyond that. They have begun the work and even the programming of the platform that will allow them to hold each other's currencies, to trade with one another without having to use the US dollar or euro or any other Western currency. And slowly, even Latin American nations were just talking, are beginning to think, hey, maybe we should also do something. This is what is happening. And these alliances are, I would say, absolutely pragmatic alliances. They are not alliances of friendship. They're alliances of, I would say, not in German, as an emergency alliance based on necessity. This is alliance of necessity come into being because those countries see a mortal danger for the world system, a mortal danger for the West, trouble lying ahead, and they need to decouple from a troubled West before the West hits the wall. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. That's not how every country puts it, how every government puts it, but I would say the way I put it summarizes the basic view, right? One of danger around the West with the Western system, and they needing to work with former enemies to finally cooperate to find an alternative currency, an alternative trading route, an alternative system.
Yeah, and we have seen Russia and China agree to bilateral trade in a combination of rubles and yuan. But like you said, there's a number of other countries that are either engaging in or in the process of discussion about bilateral trade in their own currencies versus in the dollar. And this is all also, again, going back to the beginning of what we started with, this ongoing breakdown in globalization where the U.S. dollar served as the world reserve currency. It is the currency of choice for exchange of trade, especially in commodities. We're starting to see that fray. And now you're starting to see more bilateral trade, individual trading agreements where the dollar is not serving as the main mechanism. This is a slow process. It doesn't happen, I would say, overnight, but it is something that we're increasingly seeing moving forward.
Exactly. And, you know, let's be frank. In the West, we've issued so many threats against so many countries. We've threatened countries into obedience in 2022. So nobody's going to raise hands and say, look at me, I have programmed already the first batch of the platform with my neighboring countries to trade and to so that I don't need to use US dollars. Nobody's going to be doing that, not after what we've done. But I can assure you they're doing it. It's being done. It's being done, and it's being done in a quiet way. And if I would be working for one of those governments and they asked me, you know, Washington Post or New York Times asked me, am I doing? I says, no, we're not doing anything. You know, we're just studying, talking. That's all we are doing because the stakes are high. And I think that we may see in hindsight, maybe in 2024, and I'm talking about 2024 because I think in the year 2024, there is going to be a lot of convulsion and volatility and action on the surface, at surface level. So it will be very visible. And see, in hindsight, we've made terrible mistakes in 2022. Some of our response to the invasion of Ukraine was not very smart. And in hindsight, it will have backfired on us.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Christian, because, I mean, again, we saw the beginning of the U.S.-China trade wars in 2018. Then we saw the outbreak of COVID in 2020. And then we saw the Russia-Ukraine war in 2022. So that would fit with that two-year pattern for 2024 being another year of turbulence.
You might be right with that, yeah.
Well, obviously, we have U.S. Political elections as well, which are likely to be.
I was thinking of that.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll add to the volatility.
And that's going to be a big election. Oh, goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, it very well could be. We'll have to see if Trump ends up running or not, or what happens there. That's going to be a really big factor and something that I think we're all going to be watching moving forward with a lot of the, you know, background domestic sort of fighting that's happening right now. But, you know, one thing that you've discussed, and I really appreciate the fact that you come from a European perspective. You know, you're out of Switzerland, you share your time in the UK, and so you have a lot of contacts and you do a lot of consultation, collaboration with European institutional investors. And so you're able to bring to our audience and to our listeners, you know, this understanding of how people are seeing things from a different perspective outside of the U.S. And as you said, in response to the Russia-Ukraine war, there was a number of decisions that were made that definitely give pause to a lot of international players looking from the outside in, saying, hey, this is uncharted territory, and we could be on the receiving end of this as well. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those decisions, confiscation of assets, not going through international courts, for example, a little bit about how people outside of U.S. perceive some of these events?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that here in Europe, you had a world divided, really, you know, and it can only be explained through what the world in Europe went through the years when President Trump was in the White House, when this old alliances began to be, you know, stretched a little bit, people asking questions, who is our foe, who is our enemy, who is our ally. Then the 2 years of COVID where population was divided again. Remember that. So we had here a big split in opinion about Brexit. We had then a big split in opinion about what do you think about President Trump. And then we had a big split of opinion in Europe about who gets vaccinated, this is good or not. And then we get into this war. And people also began to get equally divided how they view that war. You could say the perceived majority in the media were for the sanctions. The bigger the sanctions, the better. And they felt it was very legitimate. It's going to work very well. And we're going to destroy Russia. We're going to put an end to this war quickly. But I would say an important minority that I perceive as an important minority was very much opposed to it. Some of them, I believe the majority of them, were worried about the economic repercussions of our seizing assets of Russia, seizing assets of private people and private companies without any international court procedures, right? Just because we decree so, we did it. And most of these people, I would say, had that, you know, fear. There is on the fringes, you could see people in groups that were pro-Russia, you know, that they really felt that Russia, you know, had a right to do that, etc. But so that minority is also not homogeneous. But I would say the larger part of those people were really concerned, this is not going to end up well for us. And for different reasons, but I would say most of them economic reasons. I personally think that this is something they were seeing all over the world, except for the fact that outside of Europe, the vast majority of in the population and in the government and the government cabinets, you know, ruling parties in Africa, the Middle East, Asia, South Asia, and Latin America did not agree with our narrative. I mean, most of the world was also a bit divided, but as a whole, most of the non-Western world was very concerned about this for several reasons. Again, not homogeneous, but many of them believe the West and Russia were both responsible for it. Some believe actually even only the U.S. was responsible for this because the U.S. needed a new war after Afghanistan. And others felt that, well, we don't know who is really responsible for this, but these sanctions that the West is starting, these sanctions are going to hurt the West, but ultimately them too. It's going to hurt Latin America, it's going to hurt Africa and Asia, because they're all doing business based on our system. They're all doing business on the US dollar. They're all doing trade only with the US dollar. They're buying all their food with US dollars, you know, and holding all their savings in what? In US dollars, in euros, in pounds. So these countries were also concerned about all this aftermath. And for that reason, they were also opposed to what we were doing. So for a mix of reasons, they were opposed to our narrative. Now, I cannot finish the answer without telling you that there is a new layer to it, because overall in Europe, amongst those that supported our narrative on the war in Ukraine, the majority of them, 80% of all of these people, the people that I have contact to in Europe, I would say, do not have a lot of goodwill towards the United States. I would say they are a bit distrustful. Europeans, at least on the continent, this is not the UK, I'm not talking about the UK, but on the European continent, people are a little bit distrustful of the US. People are a little bit cautious with America. Not everyone, but let's say between 2/3 and 3/4 of the population, conservatively speaking, have a certain caution versus the United States. And for some people, I would say, is an anti-American sentiment, outright anti-American sentiment. Over the years, I've been invited by some people that they didn't like my speeches and my conference speeches to leave Europe, because they say, you know what, you keep defending America. Why don't you get out of Europe and go to America? Okay. So I've been told that for years. So I'm someone that talks to all people, and I'm glad that people share their views with me. But one thing that has happened now is this year, 2022, especially in the second half, people in Europe that underestimated America and thought America is finished, and that had also a little bit of maybe anti-American view, or maybe a wishful thinking that America's super dominance will end soon. And there's a lot of people that, I got to tell you, here on the continent, a majority of grown-up people have had this kind of desire that they hope that the world, the future, will be less American-dominated. And that, oh, the end of American dominance, please, you know, please be my guest. So they would have been against that. And this has intensified. This has intensified in recent years, this sentiment. And what we saw in 2022, I think is quite amazing, because in 2022, America showed to the world and Europe, we are back. We're not finished yet. Don't discount us. And so I think that America has shown in 2022 its tremendous geopolitical, its combined geopolitical, monetary, economic power. And I think that you have a continent now in disarray. And this now ties up with your question earlier that I answered with 2023, I think, is a year of realignments. And this continent is part of it.
Yeah, one thing that you recently discussed is how many European countries, and there's a growing sentiment in Europe, which you basically just touched upon, that are viewing some of the decisions and consequences of the Russia-Ukraine war in such a way where they see the U.S. benefiting from this ongoing war, especially with our abundant oil and gas reserves and our ability to export those, you know, to Europe and other countries. Our inflation is starting to come down. You know, if I look at Trueflation's figures, which tracks millions of different products, goods, and services, both in the U.S. and the U.K., for the U.S. right now, they're showing that we've now broken under 6%, so we're continuing to decelerate from the peak that we saw, at least according to their measure, around 12% earlier this year. But if you look at Trueflation's data for the U.K., it's at an all-time high at 20% year-over-year inflation in the U.K. So Europe and the UK are still dealing with very high rates of inflation. And so going back to, again, you know, there's this growing sentiment, perception that the US is actually benefiting or is faring a lot better in this.
Yes, it's very interesting what you mentioned. I think that what you said is really very much descriptive of what people think here, in a growing majority now. Back in May, June, if you asked me this question, I would have told you, well, you know what, the support for the U.S. and the U.S.-led coalition in support of Ukraine is overwhelming, is tremendous, is huge. And the support for the EU as well in this is huge, because the word we all heard is we are united. For the first time, we are united. We are sharing a destiny. We're sharing values, and we have shared values and a shared destiny. You know, it's what everybody said. I mean, you could even hear that in the bakery. You know, it was so overwhelming. But as the summer began to evolve, you could see already the first question marks being asked in, of all places, you could guess, Paris, right? Because the French, they have their own independent geopolitical and strategic research and analysis working for the Élysée Palace, right? So the French government is one of the only big governments in Europe that has its own military strategic analysis department, which no other nation here on the continent has, at least in Europe. And already towards the end of the summer, they were saying, wait a moment, everything that has happened to us in 2022, we see here America is the big winner of it, is the big beneficiary of it, right? And that was actually the beginning of all this change. And then the French started saying, America, you'd mentioned about inflation, but the French started looking at the gigantic commitments that the U.S. military and the State Department and the White House were expecting European allies to commit. And more than half of those commitments meant, we're going into U.S. military orders, right? So the military orders is what really caught the attention in Paris, I would say. Gigantic amounts of new military orders that would benefit the U.S. military complex. Talk about the reindustrialization of the U.S., right? This reindustrialization of the U.S., some people started saying already in August, September, will come very easily. Just cheap energy, a gigantic difference between the price of energy between the U.S. and Europe, and massive military orders, right? And then came the end of the year when President Biden announced the U.S. Inflation Protection Act, right? Or Inflation Reduction Act, whatever you want to call it. Now, that act is actually the implementation, some people say here, not just a few people, quite a few people around the world, in China, Asia, India, and Europe call it Trump number two, because Trump said America first. Well, this Biden Inflation Act is really, they say, Trump two, because it's really putting America's economy first. And I think people in America, I understand America is a big country. People don't have time to look at the rest of the world. But one thing that they may underestimate is to see that how the rest of the world sees it, that a lot of people are out there in the world now see that America has been probably preparing this and working at this for years now. And that it's not just a Republican thing. It's probably also a Democratic thing. It's probably just in America, a Washington thing, not America, but a Washington thing. So I can tell you that the what this just this was more or less, you could say, a France-centric concern in the summer and remained a France-centric concern because France, and people say, well, but maybe the French are just picking on these big U.S. benefits on the military side, the Pentagon orders, just because the French always wanted a separate European military, right? People said that. But then came the sabotage of the pipeline, of the gas pipeline, right? And that big sabotage, really, at the first day, everybody said this was surely Russia. And then everybody was quiet here. You know, our governments went quiet. And that quietness, silence of our government, silence in Washington made a lot of people nervous. And then Berlin didn't talk to Washington for weeks. And people started adding things together, you know, and then both Berlin and France changing their tone against Washington, a real anger, you could say. And actually, it's actually nobody talks about it because people, I think a large majority now, it's a clear majority of people here in Europe and amongst thought leaders believe that something has gone wrong with the Transatlantic Alliance in 2022. And they don't want to change our cooperation in Ukraine or in favor of Ukraine because they believe that Ukraine needs our support. So we shouldn't do anything that could jeopardize or threaten or risk that NATO-EU cooperation in Ukraine. And for that reason, people are very quiet with what they really think. But what I hear from behind closed doors is really, it's not overwhelming, but it is already a majority of thought leaders that believe that the U.S. was not very forthcoming, that President Biden was probably not as forthcoming as President Trump even. President Biden has been having his agenda, and that much of what's happened in 2022, President Biden did, you know, to benefit him, his party, his elections, and probably America. And so the distrust is there. And I would say the distrust is much bigger than the trust now. Unfortunately, this has come to a time when the situation in Europe is very bad, right? It's very bad. So I think that that only makes things worse. People are not speaking aloud. I mean, very few people are really speaking aloud. I think that a very small minority of the people that I know of are willing to share their views really aloud, unless they are really in line with the broad mainstream consensus, right? So, but I've seldom have seen the media consensus here, what we call mainstream media consensus, so detached from what the majority of people are thinking on the street.
So as you mentioned, you know, there's a rift among European countries and even between the U.S. and Europe. And there is a narrative that is very popular in thinking that NATO and U.S. and the West have never been as united as they are now. But you're saying, you know, under the surface, there's a bit more tension. And you had also mentioned earlier that the U.S. Inflation Protection Act also fits into this as well. And you had talked about in one of your prior reports how this will actually hurt European companies. And this is also part of this, perhaps, you know, growing rift that we are seeing. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How is the U.S. Inflation Protection Act perhaps driving a bit more of a wedge there?
I think the problem is not necessarily the name of it. The problem is, I think, is what is done in Washington, you know, that you have a very good package, a very good law, a very good idea. It becomes a big package. More and more stuff is added onto it, right? And what started as a very good initiative to reduce inflation in the United States ended up, I would think, is being I would say, enriched with U.S. first, America first kind of policies, right? Where, for instance, the government of the U.S. is going to give huge subsidies, huge support, government money to companies that produce here in the United States, okay, in the U.S. U.S. technology, U.S. production, U.S. labor being applied, and also providing indirectly already incentives for companies to relocate to the United States. Okay, if only seeing as an individual act by the U.S., individual law, it wouldn't have so much power, but it is now happening at a time when the energy prices in Europe are so incredibly much higher than in the U.S. And that is the context that hasn't gone lost in Europe. With this kind of energy price differentials, this Inflation Protection Act could kill quite a few European industries. It could kill them. The view here in Europe is that this Inflation Protection Act is going to attract companies from Europe to the U.S. Not just growth company growing in the U.S., no longer sending production overseas. That's going to happen anyway. But to actually force some companies in Europe to, let's say, close shop. I mean, there are many companies in Europe that are considering going bankrupt or facing bankruptcy because of the high energy prices. And I think many of them will probably just say, well, we finish production here and we move to the U.S. This is the fear that people have. I'm speaking very bluntly now.
You know, if you look at the bill itself on the White House's website, you know, it does talk about Make It in America, this growing effort for both reshoring and nearshoring, and like you said, massive subsidies to companies to do that. So one thing that you had mentioned is that this obviously does hurt Europe, especially those areas where we do import large amounts of goods and services in these strategic sectors. And at the same time, as you said, the important backdrop here is that Europe is still facing extremely high energy and gas prices, extremely high inflation. So that does make the U.S. far more competitive compared to Europe. So this is part of those growing tensions that, you know, the U.S. is benefiting or is at least hurt way less than Europe, given the situation that's unfolding. And so we're likely to see some realignment of alliances or new alliances being formed under the surface as we move into 2023, given some of the scenarios that we outlined today.
We have seen already a little bit of that. After what happened with the Nord Stream sabotage, Berlin was very quiet for some time. They talked to Paris, but soon after that, China contacted the German government, and requested that Germany sells part of the strategic port of Hamburg to China. Something that China had requested in the past, but Berlin had always said, come on, don't bother us with this. But after the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline, China asked again for it. He never got a positive answer from Berlin before, but Berlin said very quickly, you got it. You know, and again, it was not a unanimous decision by the government, but a majority in the German government said enough is enough. We have to show to Washington, and this is now how I interpret it, we have to show to Washington that we cannot take everything. We're not going to take everything. And we are now willing to re-engage with China, which is obviously the biggest ally of Russia now in this war. So Germany decided to re-engage with China and sell that part of this important part of strategic port of Hamburg to China. I think that that process of realignment has already begun.
And again, I think we should point out that something that we often mention that you will say to our listeners is that this is not a matter of moralizing various decisions that are made by each respective country. But as you have made very clear, you know, every country acts in its own strategic self-interest. And so we need to expect that. And as these strategic self-interests are pursued, there will be consequences and ripple effects that come from that. So it's not a matter of good and bad. It's just a matter of this is reality. And these are how things are likely to play out as we're looking forward.
Yes. And I don't think that everyone can do research and analysis as I do. I think that every type of analysis has its own right to exist. What I see out there is that a lot of commentary and analysis is already passing judgment. There is a lot out there that is passing judgment, and there is a place for that, a necessity for that. And what we try to do here is to contribute with as objective and balanced an analysis as possible, which is looking at what consensus is probably underestimating. So this is the background of the analysis that I've just shared with you.
Well, again, I want to point out to all of you listening, you know, Christian Takushi, as I mentioned at the beginning of this interview, made a very clear and loud warning on the markets for 2022 and the fact that the Fed was likely to shock the markets. And the Wall Street consensus was not pricing that in. We certainly saw that. That was ahead of consensus. That was not something that consensus was expecting or discussing at the time. And Christian was ahead of that. And just the same, you know, talking about how there's no easy exit from this European energy crisis. And as we discussed today, this also plays out when we think about recent decisions, recent legislation with the Inflation Reduction Act, the reshoring, and some of the shifting and realignment of alliances that we see in the background, all of which we should expect to continue into 2023. And perhaps just echo a point we made earlier, Christian, we might be seeing that two-year turbulence pattern, you know, the 2018 U.S.-China trade wars, 2020 COVID lockdowns and disruptions, 2022 Russia-Ukraine war. We might be seeing that pattern play out for 2024 as well, especially given the widely anticipated U.S. political elections.
It might pan out that way.
We'll have to see. All right. Well, Christian, I want to thank you for coming on and giving us an update on your outlook and some of the things that you're discussing. As we close, what would be the best way for our listeners to follow more of your work?
They can subscribe to our newsletter. I think this is the best way because only the newsletter readers get our research immediately. And otherwise, some of our research is published from time to time on the website, geopoliticalresearch.com.
Okay. Well, we will have links to geopoliticalresearch.com and a number of other ways in which you can follow Christian's work, where this interview is posted at Financial Sense. So definitely want to encourage all of you to take advantage of those and certainly listen to some of the prior interviews that we've done with Christian as well, which we'll have posted. Christian, always a pleasure to have you on our show, and we look forward to speaking with you in 2023.
Thank you so much, Chris. Happy New Year.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.